Next up, HealthLink on Air. Tonight we'll talk about the growing threat of Lyme disease.
The ticks can transmit from the deer to us and or deer to the environment to us as well. People are in, who are in the woods, they have more exposure to these ticks.
Plus, how hernias and abdominal wall injuries occur and the treatments available.
Just making an incision in the abdomen may result in this problem. Even if it's well closed at the end of an operation, due to many, many different factors, some related to the operation, some related to the patient, patients will develop those hernias.
And we discuss how our sense of a meaningful life evolves as we age.
Gerontology, we like to say that old age is not for sissies. It's a challenging time of life.
We'll get advice on being safe from summer heat and hear from our healing muse, all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, we'll explore some new approaches to hernia repair. And what is one's sense of coherence and how does it change as we age? But first, the rate of Lyme disease has more than tripled in this country. What you need to know about this controversial disease. Often blamed for a myriad of long-term, nagging, and sometimes unexplained symptoms, Lyme disease continues to plague certain regions of this country. And Central New York just happens to be seen as one center for this disease. Dr. Waleed Javed, Associate Professor of Medicine and the Director of Infection Control at Upstate Medical University, is here with us with more on this. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for inviting me.
So Lyme disease really continues to daunt us with symptoms, and there have been claims of long-term infection and lingering symptomatology. Let's begin by telling us scientifically what we know about Lyme disease. First of all, what exactly is it?
So it's a bacterial illness that is transmitted via a vector called a tick, in this case, from an animal host like deer or mice or other animals to humans.
And the name of the bacteria is Borrelia burgdorferi.
Burgdorferi, you're absolutely right. You can pronounce it.
I could barely pronounce it. And it is transmitted to humans through the bite of this, basically, this infected black-legged tick.
Yes.
And we get that as a result of being exposed to the ticks in our yards, in our forests, all around. But what role does the deer play?
So they are the main hosts of the disease itself, and they kind of keep the, they have these ticks on them. They help spread of the ticks. The ticks can transmit from the deer to us and or deer to the environment to us as well. People who hike, who are in the woods, they have more exposure to these ticks.
So if you're out there, you're hiking, or you're in your garden even these days, you might be more exposed.
You might be more exposed.
And is there a time of year, because this has been controversial, there's a lot of controversy around Lyme, but one of the controversies I've heard is that Lyme can be out there, these deer ticks can be there all year long. Is that really the case?
So mostly it is during summer and spring and summer, probably autumn, but not in the wintertime, not in upstate New York when we are covering ourselves from head to toe. The tick won't find a space to bite us.
So we'll be protected from that standpoint. Even if they are out there, we're covered, which will lead us to later when we talk about prevention, another way to prevent that exposure. So the ticks can attach to any part of the human body, but I've seen that the most humans become infected by these nymphs, which are the very earliest stage of the tick, the little babies. Why does that present a problem?
Because the nymphs, these are very small. You can't really see them very easily until you're looking for them, and people often miss them. They also actually bite us in places like in back, in places that we won't be able to see it ourselves easily. On the other hand, the adults are slightly bigger, and they're easier to find and to see, and to remove.
So in other words, but the difficulty is when you have a nymph that may be infecting you, it could be in your groin area or your scalp or someplace where it's not as apparent, but they're so tiny. Even I heard someone as small as a poppy seed. So that's really tiny. Mm-hmm. And that's often why they may go unnoticed.
Yes.
So that is problematic. How long does it take from the time that the tick attaches to the body before the Lyme disease bacterium can be transmitted?
So it's usually said about 36 to 48 hours are required. So about at least more than a day the tick needs to be on us before we can safely say there's a substantial transmission of the disease itself.
So the bottom line here is it underscores the importance of hypervigilance during these seasons when you're out and about to check your body. Because if you can get it, remove the tick, which mm-hmm. we'll talk about later how to, before that period has elapsed, it's unlikely that the disease will have been transmitted via the tick. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
So how do you know you have it? What are some of the symptoms that you would find?
So with Lyme disease itself, there's several stages, if you would, but majority of times Lyme disease is detected by the classical rash, which is called the bullseye rash. That is very easy to detect. A lot of people have good awareness about it. Physicians have awareness about the bullseye rash,
and so it looks like a bullseye, or like on the target, the target icon.
And it is pretty substantial. So there's central clearing or central normal looking skin with the surrounding red skin, which actually is pretty pathognomic for, especially with the right history, would be very consistent with the disease itself.
Do you have other symptoms like fever or fatigue or headache as well?
It all really depends on how much or how far it has spread and what stage you're looking at. Sometimes you see this bullseye alien a few weeks after the tick by yourself. If you miss it, you can still have these target lesions, probably a lot more target lesions on the skin at the later stages of disease. And at that time, you can have a lot more symptoms as well.
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of how it progresses over time. Mm. But the point is, not everyone has a rash. Is that correct?
Yes.
I'd say I read somewhere like 80 or 85% of the time you'll see a rash. And sometimes it isn't the target rash. Sometimes it's a broader. kind of rash. But some people don't have the rash, and that also can possibly lead to non-diagnosis, I guess, or not picking up the fact that you might have it. So when should you see a doctor?
So if you are concerned about the disease, about your exposure, you have had maybe a rash, maybe some other symptoms that you're concerned about, you should always consult with a physician. And again, there is enough local expertise available that can be addressed.
So how is it, you mentioned that it can be diagnosed in a sense from that symptom, especially something like as prominent as that type of bullseye rash. But are there other means of diagnosis? How is the diagnosis actually made?
So again, the diagnosis is made both by the classical history, exposure history, then maybe the rash, maybe not the rash, but also there are other tests available that we can perform. They're authentic. Authenticated tests. They're very reliable tests or reproducible tests that we can do.
And what is that exactly? Are you taking blood samples and trying to find some kind of a reaction in the blood? Tell us about that.
So it is blood samples taken from the patients. They show exposure to ticks and specifically to Borrelia burgdorferi, and they actually would detect the acute stage of the illness in determining our immune response, and then also that can tell us if there is any chronic nature to it.
So in fact, what's happening is, is that the body, what you're really testing for is the body's immune response mm-hmm. to this bacterium.
Right.
And that is the kind of the measure that you're using to see if in fact it's mm-hmm. the body's been infected by this tick. But it can take up to 2 weeks for that response to show in the blood. Is there a problem then? In other words, you might test early and after finding a tick and maybe not seeing a rash and then there's no indication of Lyme, is it the kind of thing that you need to make sure that you test on a, you know, a repetitive basis to make sure?
So, for example, a person who's not taking proper precautions and is on, in the woods and areas where there's high incidence of Lyme disease, those might be tested more regularly. And if you have, if I see a patient who had very classical symptoms, a very classical rash, everything else, and their tests come back negative, I might repeat the test at maybe within a month, and that should show us the results. So it's already case dependent.
But are there consequences for that 2 week lag in terms of treatment? Would treatment still be effective if you were to start it?
If you have a good history, you can give treatment. There's several levels of treatment with one pill, 14 days, 21 days, or 4 weeks of treatment. There's several levels of treatment that can be given at several times, and again, we can easily treat it.
So what is the treatment?
So the treatment, I don't want to go into a lot of details, but it's by an oral pill called doxycycline. In fact, that is one of the most effective treatments for it. The other treatment can be another oral drug called amoxicillin. A third treatment, which is done for cases that are involving the central nervous system or joints or heart, is called ceftriaxone, which is an IV antibiotic, intravenous antibiotic.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Dr. Waleed Javed, and we're talking about infection. He's the director of infection control at Upstate Medical University. We're talking about Lyme disease. So, just help us understand the natural progression of the disease if it's left untreated. What happens? What are the kind of levels of symptoms that you see?
So, again, there are cases that are left untreated. In fact, when Lyme disease was initially found, people were found to have these chronic joint problems at ages that were age inappropriate initially when it was discovered in the area called Lyme in Connecticut.
So it was first discovered in Connecticut. And you're saying people who are too young to have arthritis were showing arthritis? Is that what you're saying?
Arthritis and other symptoms that were unclear. So there is chronicity that can be attributable to this disease. The main thing really is that how does it present? So if we don't treat anyone, 60% of people can have some chronic lingering symptoms.
So this is a true thing. I mean, I know there's a lot of controversy around Lyme and the suggestion that people much, much later in their lives, maybe not even knowing if they've been bitten, will attribute some of these later symptoms or symptoms that they're having to Lyme. But the truth is, it has been shown that there are some chronic long-term effects of Lyme if left untreated, such as arthritis. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned something about heart problems as
well.
Heart
problems, there can be neurological problems are far more common. There is more issues, again, but these are all treatable as well.
And how are those treated?
So again, with IV or oral antibiotics for a limited time, not for years and years.
Okay, I want to make that point. So if I were to come to you as a patient after 2 years, let's say I thought maybe I got bitten 2 years ago and I've started to show some of these symptoms, you could still treat me with an antibiotic course, just not a long-term antibiotic course. Is that correct?
Yes, but there's a lot, I just want to put it out there as there's a lot of controversy in that. What I'm recommending, what I follow really is what CDC and Infectious Disease Society of America recommends. And these are all two authenticated sites. They have a lot of literature. And again, cdc.gov and other websites, you can go and see the recommendations and treatment options. But then if you search on the internet, you find a lot of other opinions by people without a lot of good evidence. So
it's not data-based. It may be just, in a sense, it's
opinion-based and or thought-based. There's a lot of discussion going on, active discussion, but again, the data still supports and has been tested again and again. Data supports the mainstream treatment, which is limited.
Short-term antibiotic intervention will help these other issues.
Yeah. A lot of people make tend to make a lot of money if they treat for a long time with antimicrobials. But I would not want to go into details of that.
So the bottom line is, definitely these antibiotics can be effective even later on in the progression of this disease, but not over long periods of time.
Yes.
There's no evidence to show that that's helpful at all.
Mm-hmm.
Let's get to prevention, and we only have about another minute or so.
Mm-hmm.
What do you recommend?
So that's very, very good question. I think the prevention is the key. Wearing long sleeves, wearing boots, wearing appropriate attire when you're gardening, using DEET or other insect repellents are important. If you're hiking, if your activities are engaging, then check yourself or ask a partner to check you. You check your partner. Make sure you look at all places that could be there.
And how about your pets? Those as well? You check your pets as well?
It's always a good idea
children.
To make sure children and pets that are unable to properly tell you about this should be checked.
And then if you find a tick, what do?
You can try to remove it. There is a very good graphic on CDC.gov website that you can look at. You can use a pair of tweezers that are available. It's very easy to remove. In fact, I've removed it from my own kids as well. And you should be able to do it. If you are unable to or you're having difficulty, contact your healthcare provider.
But if you find this tick and mm-hmm. you're not certain how long the tick has been there, do you routinely recommend a short term of doxycycline at that point?
So there's treatment recommendation of the tick by itself. There's some evidence that suggests that giving a dose of doxycycline at that time is helpful. Depending on case-by-case basis, when the case presents to us, it could be one dose, it could be 2 weeks, it could be several different levels.
But from your perspective as an infectious disease expert, do you see Lyme as being treatable and curable for the most part?
For the most part, it is. We also should remember that the same tick can carry other organisms. And I just want to mention that here, that other organisms, other viruses, parasites, and or other disease-causing organisms can be there. So if there is no real improvement with treatment directed towards Lyme disease with positive tests, other tests can be done for other diseases to detect and treat other accompanying organisms that could be transmitted by the same tick.
By the same tick. That mm-hmm. says, let's keep away from ticks. So prevention strikes me as probably one of the key takeaway messages.
Absolutely. An ounce of prevention. That's exactly where we should start. And we don't want to get exposed to insects, mosquitoes, and ticks, especially in upstate New York.
Well, thank you
season.
So much. My guest has been Dr. Waleed Javed. He's Associate Professor of Medicine and the Director of Infection Control at Upstate Medical University. Next up, some new approaches to hernia repair. You're listening to HealthLink on Air. HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen here with you. There are approximately 11 million auto accidents each year in this country, resulting in more than 40,000 deaths. And getting to the hospital and a designated trauma center may mean the difference between life and death. Joining us with more on this is Dr. Mustafa Hassan, Associate Professor of Surgery and the Director of Acute Care Surgery Section at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Hassan. Thank you for coming in. Thank you very much for having me. So it can be a matter of life and death to get to a trauma center after a motor vehicle accident. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. Within the first few minutes of trauma, this is the most critical time for a patient to get to a designated trauma center or an equipped trauma center. We are a level 1 trauma center. We have an excellent EMS system that provides transport from the site of the injury, from the field to the hospital. Early intervention and resuscitation may mean life or death in this situation.
What does it actually mean to be a level one trauma center, though?
A level one trauma center is a place or a hospital that has all the resources needed by a trauma victim to address all the injuries. For example, at Upstate, which is a level one trauma center, we do have trauma surgeons that are available 24 hours a day. We do have neurosurgeons, orthopedic surgeons, plastic surgeons, a designated intensive care unit, and every resource you can think of to care for such a critically injured patient.
Wow, so it is important to have all those players in place and highly trained to know what to expect and how to deal with it.
Correct.
So as a trauma surgeon, which you are, and you work in this type of setting, you're seeing sometimes traumatic injuries that now require a new approach to repairing the abdominal wall. Tell us about that.
Well, there is a paradigm shift in the care for trauma victims, and that happened over the last decade, evolved. It's called damage control strategies. What happened in the past is a trauma victim would come in with a major abdominal injury, either from a motor vehicle accident or from a stab wound or a gunshot wound. Patients would be taken to the operating room and spent hours in the operating room trying to fix those injuries. But we have recently learned, or over the last decade, not really recently, that doing that may have a very poor outcome on those patients. So what we currently do is we do what is known as damage control. We open the abdomen, we go in and temporize, stop the bleeding, stop the contamination, or temporarily take care of the injuries, and leave the abdomen open and covered by a special dressing. And the patients go back to the intensive care unit to be warmed, resuscitated, stabilized, and then come back to the operating room once again, or twice, or three, or four, or sometimes many, many times until their abdomen is actually closed. Although that has its problems, but has been associated with way better outcome and less mortality.
So in a part of this, though, is something that I was kind of found very interesting. There is such a thing as an abdominal wall hernia that can occur during these kinds of injuries. What exactly is that?
Absolutely. Leaving the abdomen open, and that's not only for trauma, but for also acute catastrophic general surgery problems like a hole in the colon or a hole in the intestines, all those problems, we end up with an abdomen that's open, and it becomes very difficult to close it. And sometimes closure in itself produces this hernia, which is a defect in the abdominal wall through which organs can protrude, covered by the skin, but that is the definition of a hernia.
So in other words, the abdominal wall and all of the musculature and all of the structures that would be up below the skin that would protect the inner organs, it's not totally closed, and those organs push through.
Correct.
And that obviously can be quite a serious problem.
Yes, that results in a hernia by definition.
So what do you do in those circumstances? And is it always, those are always as a result of some kind of traumatic injury that has taken place?
Actually, those hernias are not only a result of trauma, but they are a result of any surgical procedure involving the abdomen, which is also known as an incisional hernia. Just making an incision in the abdomen may result in this problem, where even if it's well closed at the end of an operation, due to many, many different factors, some related to the operation, some related to the patient, patients will develop those hernias, those large, complex hernias.
And so what do you do in that circumstance? How are they treated?
Well, they are treated. There is a multidisciplinary approach that we have for those conditions.
Do you need to reoperate in that case?
Absolutely. Usually the treatment is surgical, after good preparation and patient selection, preparation with the patient, and it's a surgical repair.
And in that case, let's get back to this gunshot wound or the person who's come in with a traumatic injury. You've done this staging in terms of their repair. So they've come in, you've stabilized them, they have an open abdomen, they necessarily then have to go back on several occasions to repair their abdomen, and still they might end up at a later date with a hernia.
Correct.
Is that correct? And then they must return again to the operating room. Is that ever done laparoscopically, you know, less invasively when you do that repair?
That's a great question. Definitely. There are different ways to fix those hernias. Some of them are open, some are laparoscopically, and recently we're doing a lot of them robotically. But that's all depends on the size of the hernia and the patient and the conditions around it. So the patient selection is very important.
And the laparoscopic procedure, is it less obviously, or the robotic procedure, is it less time and healing? I mean, what are the benefits of doing it that way versus opening
them up again? It is less invasive. We make 3 or 4 small incisions, so the recovery is faster, pain is less. But the most important thing is patient selection, because not everybody, not every hernia is suitable for that kind of repair.
So the question is, though, why do you need to repair it? I mean, let's assume this person's gone through all of these, this traumatic experience, and they finally been stabilized and you've closed the abdomen and then a little hernia develops secondary to that. Is it necessary to repair and why?
Well, not in every situation hernia is necessary to be repaired. But having a big abdominal hernia is a hardship for a lot of people, actually.
In what ways? What does it do?
First, this is a defect in the abdominal wall through which organs protrude. So complications can happen. What we call incarceration, which means the intestines that are sticking outside, basically.
And they can get strangulated.
Exactly. You can get incarcerated and then get strangulated, and then becomes a surgical emergency. And emergencies are usually managed in a suboptimal way rather than elective surgery.
So you would always, well, whenever possible, make a repair?
In a suitable candidate, in a patient who has symptoms, it probably should be repaired.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with trauma surgeon Dr. Mustafa Hassan. And we're talking about surgical interventions specifically to do with the abdominal wall at this point and hernias. What new materials are being used, or are there new materials that are being used these days?
There are many, many types of reinforcement materials in the market. It's a huge industry, and the duty of the surgeon is to select the suitable material for the suitable patient.
So there's something called mesh, or is that the general name for all of these?
Well, there are two kinds of material that we use. One of them is meshes in general, and the other one is what we call a biological graft. And these are tissue grafts. Some of them are made from cadaveric skin. Some are made from pig skin. Some are made from cow skin. But they usually come from a tissue of a living organism.
And then they are put in place where the hole, let's say, exists in the abdominal wall?
The ultimate repair of a hernia is to be able to bring the patient's muscles back together again, to give the patient the function that they want, ability to function and move around, and also to reinforce this usually from the undersurface with that kind of material. We assume at this point the muscle is not strong enough and hernia can occur again, so reinforcement is very important.
Going back to this whole notion of hernias, though, I mean, it's something that is quite common. I'm not talking now ones that are caused by a traumatic event necessarily, but you'll often hear people say, oh, I have had a hernia and I've had to have a hernia repair. Tell me about what causes these kinds of hernias and who are at risk for them.
Well, it's very unpredictable who would get a hernia. And when we say hernias, most people would think it's in the groin. Groin hernias are pretty common. However, what we're talking about or dealing with mainly now is the incisional hernias, which are a result of trauma, as we have mentioned, or a previous incision.
And those occur largely where, then?
Usually in the abdomen, following an abdominal incision or a flank incision sometimes. And they are a hardship. They are a hardship for people who have them.
How so, though? I mean, what does it do to your daily living?
People are usually under the threat of having the hernia incarcerate or strangulate
while
I'm on a vacation, while I'm fishing in Florida, while I'm doing this or that. That's one thing. The other thing is chronic pain, because the hernias protrude, and every time people eat or move around, there is chronic pain. Besides the lack of function, imagine if you have an abdominal wall defect, your muscle is not functioning as well as somebody who has an intact abdominal wall. So also, there are some cosmetic issues, because those hernias can get very large and be very obvious and produce cosmetic hardship for people, if you will.
So for all those reasons, it sounds like repair should be most often the choice.
if possible, in a suitable candidate.
And what would be the candidates who might not be suitable?
Not all of those operations are simple. They'd be complex, and the patient have to be first, something like smoking, for example, you know, kind of rules the operation out, at least temporarily.
So if you're a smoker, what other high risk or other activities might limit your ability to have that repair?
Morbid obesity. Sometimes we have to address that issue first to bring the patient to be a candidate for the operation.
So you might have to lose a lot of weight before or have some kind of other procedure.
Correct. Sometimes that is the case.
So what exactly, I mean, at this point, you have seen, you have a, for those kinds of hernias, you have a multidisciplinary approach. Can you tell me what that means?
We are putting together a multidisciplinary team to address this issue. And that team is formed of hernia surgeons. People are surgeons who are really, that's a big part of their practice. Plastic surgeons, because sometimes we need their expertise in moving flaps and covering that defect. Physical therapists, nutritionists. A patient navigator, who is usually a nurse or a nurse practitioner, who would receive the patient. We're trying to create a program that's really geared towards, centered towards the patient.
Patient-centered approach.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And the idea here is to be able to offer, I mean, obviously you need physical therapy following a surgical procedure like that in terms of your rehabilitation.
Correct.
And nutritional help as well often?
Definitely.
And why is that? Is
it because for good healing, you need good nutrition. Uh-huh. So a lot of the patients don't have that to start with. So we work with them prior to the surgery and bring them up to the point where the outcome is predicted to be very good nutritionally.
Wonderful. So at this point, you have a team that's in place and you're working hard to kind of get the word out, I guess, about this entire enterprise.
Correct.
That's wonderful. Well, I thank you so much for coming in. This is very interesting. And I never realized that people could really have that kind of problem secondary to an auto accident to end up with a basic problem with your abdominal wall. So it was very enlightening. My guest has been Dr. Mustafa Hassan, Associate Professor of Surgery and Anesthesiology at Upstate Medical University, and he is the Director of the Acute Care Surgery Section at Upstate. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to HealthLink on Air. Some expert advice from the experts at Upstate. Dr. Derek Cooney, an associate professor of emergency medicine, is here with some info about heat illnesses.
The summer weather attracts many of us to enjoy the outdoors. It's important to remember that the summer sun and heat may also cause problems with our health, however. In addition to sunburns, we may also need to be aware of heat illness. Most people understand the risks of sunburn and skin cancer, and that acute care of sunburn might even require evaluation by a physician if it is severe. But the heat itself can lead to problems, especially for individuals who have a lesser tolerance for swings in temperature. You know, typically this is the very young children and seniors who have greater difficulty regulating their body temperature and may not be able to cool themselves as well as younger adults and older children. Certain medications also can make some of us more likely to become dehydrated or succumb to heat illness. Some important symptoms to look for include dark-colored urine or dizziness, headache, muscle cramps, nausea, pale skin, profuse sweating, rapid heartbeat, fatigue, confusion, or even fainting from the heat. Heat exhaustion worsens into heat stroke, and permanent injury or even death can occur from untreated heat illness. This is a very serious concern. So everyone should keep well hydrated, keep to an air-conditioned or shaded areas as much as possible, and wear sunscreen. You should also avoid strenuous activity while exposed to the heat. Avoiding alcohol and caffeine can also help. And checking on elderly and less fortunate neighbors is a very important measure to ensure that they have air conditioning or a cool place to go if their home becomes too hot and can potentially save them from becoming victims of the heat. If you notice the symptoms I've just mentioned in yourself or someone else, you know, you should immediately move to a cool, shaded area and encourage hydration with clear fluids. If the individual or yourself has persistent symptoms, or if they have any signs of headache or confusion or fainting, immediate medical attention is needed. And 911 should be called and the person brought to the emergency department for us to take care of. Cooling is essential, and simple interventions can help, like misting or using fans, cold packs to the neck, armpit, and groin might be needed. And EMS providers might use cool or cold IV fluids in some cases to decrease the body temperature. In the emergency department, patients can be treated with advanced measures for cooling, including cooling blankets, cold IV fluids, and other more invasive techniques to save a critically ill patient that suffered severe heat injury. When someone has a heat-related injury, they may also be more susceptible to heat in the future and should not take any chances by becoming exposed to similar conditions in the future. It is crucial to take precautions to avoid heat-related illnesses. Look out for your friends, family, coworkers, and neighbors, and seek immediate emergency medical attention when serious symptoms arise.
Coming up next, what exactly is a sense of coherence, and how does it change as we age? You're listening to HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. When examining the factors that impact on one's quality of life, several have been cited. A sense of well-being, having meaning and value in your life, and an overall sense of coherence. We'll hear with more on this and how these factors change with age is Dr. Merrill Silverstein, Professor of Sociology and Social Work, and the Marjorie Cantor Professor of Aging Studies at Syracuse University. Welcome. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So let's begin by helping us understand what we mean when we say sense of coherence. What is that?
Well, sense of coherence is a concept that was developed by Aaron Antonovsky, an Israeli social epidemiologist, who was interested in studying the internal resources that we bring to life when we experience problems and usually health issues that challenge us and allow us to then overcome them in various ways. It comprises three aspects. One is comprehensibility, the ability to understand the world, make sense of it. Another one is manageability, which is our ability to control the world, to have competence, efficacy in our daily lives. And the third is meaningfulness, that is how much satisfaction we derive emotionally in life.
And all of those three together will give you a sense of basically what he considers coherence in your life. Mm-hmm. Well, how does that relate, if at all, to this notion of a purpose in life? Because many times when we talk about satisfaction in life or peacefulness in life or a sense of well-being, we talk about this idea of having purpose. Mm-hmm. How do the two relate to one another?
Well, I think it's a very close relationship. What Antonovsky, I think, pioneered was the idea that you can look at the individual elements of coherence, the three that I just spoke about, which together form a sense of purpose in life, a goal direction that gives one a sense of meaningfulness, an idea that life has a purpose, a goal, even if it's not in your natural lifetime, it could be in generations that extend from you.
Oh, that's interesting. So it can actually go beyond your own life, in a sense.
Absolutely. It's putting yourself in a larger context, whether that's a social context or some other kind of context where your life has meaning and giving to others as you move along.
It's interesting because also that notion of efficacy is always one that I've thought of as being very important, that people have a sense that they matter in the world and that they have, whether they have ultimate control, which none of us have really, over their lives, that in some sense, maybe on a day-to-day basis, they have a sense that what their actions do or their actions are somewhat effective mm-hmm. in terms of relating to the world.
I think that's right. The idea that your actions have consequences for others, but also for yourself, I think that's maybe the important thing with regard to aging, that you can take care of yourself, that you can manage your health in a way that at least minimizes risk. We all know that aging produces a large amount of deficits, a large amount of challenges, gerontology, we like to say that old age is not for sissies. It's a challenging time of life. But if you have that kind of internal resource that you can bring to the situation, that you can solve problems to the extent that you can within the bounds that are possible, you will do better in your life.
What makes it strong? In other words, what allows it to develop unimpeded? Or what are the factors that allow this to develop in a strong way in a person?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are two sets of factors. One you might call stable factors that we have very early in our lives, such as higher education, greater income. And we have things that also change, the second group, which would be declining health, declining function, the increased risk of disease, the loss of loved ones, including parents, including friends, and so on, where our social world maybe narrows quite a bit. And so if we can minimize that or allow older people to take advantage or have more access to resources in the society, we have the potential to minimize the risk of loss of losing sense of coherence.
Right. And we'll talk more about that and about your particular research and what you found in the study that you did. But I'm curious in terms of what you think. You said higher education, but are there other kind of more fundamental factors that would allow it to develop perhaps more strongly? You know, there are other terms that are used, resilience. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of these terms that are thrown about in terms of personal character, determination. What do you think plays the major role in allowing this to develop in a person?
Well, the idea of successful aging is often wrapped around the idea of adaptability. You mentioned resilience, that older people can adjust to the objective deficits that they experience, whether that's taking up an activity that maybe is less demanding, whether that's forming new relationships, or whether that's simply downgrading one's expectations about what's possible. That's the psychosocial element that I think the sense of coherence addresses most directly.
When do you think this sense of coherence, as he talks about it, actually is developed fully? I mean, you know, when we're talking about the whole lifespan, when would you see that as having been developed fully?
Well, we did a fairly comprehensive search of the literature and found that there's actually very little about how it changes through time and almost nothing about how it changes through old age into advanced old age. And so that was part of the research that we did on this topic. The thinking on this was that sense of coherence was a stable trait. That is, you developed it relatively young. It was based on your access to education and your ability to kind of train yourself in finding meaning in life, usually as a result of parental training.
Perhaps having a loving family.
A loving family, a social context that could support you. And then we hypothesized that perhaps there's some change that goes on after midlife.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here, along with gerontologist Dr. Meryl Silverstein, and we're talking about how one's sense of meaning and purpose in life can change with age. So your hypothesis, and you just did the perfect segue to what we want to talk about, which is your research. You had a hypothesis that this sense of coherence may change in some way. Tell us about what the hypothesis was and how you tried to determine the mm-hmm. answer to that.
Well, given the nature of the concept that it has to do with our ability to cope with the onslaughts of aging, we hypothesized that there would be a decline in sense of coherence as one passed the threshold into advanced old age, from middle age to early old age, and then on to later old age.
What constitutes later old age to you in terms of age numbers?
Well, that's debated in the field, but typically 85 and over is considered the oldest old. It's sometimes called the fourth age. It's sometimes called the frail years. So your risk of having disability and health conditions increases markedly after 85. And so we hypothesized that it would go down with time, but that the absence, perhaps, of deficits, that is, being able to maintain your health to the extent possible, to avoid losses in friends and family, would mitigate that decline.
So what did you do?
Well, what we did is address the question using a unique data set from Sweden, which tracked people from midlife, mid-50s, to really up to 100 years old.
This was already a pre-existing set of data?
This is a pre-existing data set in Sweden that allowed us to look at changing sense of coherence over this lengthy period of time and make some conclusions.
Why did you choose Swedish data? Was it because this was an available data set? Or?
Yeah, well, there are several reasons. One is I've been working in Sweden for the last 15 years.
Oh, okay.
Very familiar with Swedish data. And also Swedish data, as well as most Scandinavian data, are very good. They're high quality. They have very little in the way of refusals. They're very accurate. They get information from what's called registries, which are based on the whole population. So it's a very good data set. And this concept was measured longitudinally over 4 or 5 different waves of data. And that's rare to have one concept being measured over a long period of time.
So someone had already begun to compile
yes.
the data on this idea of sense of coherence.
Yes.
Is there something about the Swedish culture that perhaps weighs in on this?
I think so. To generalize, maybe dangerously, but maybe accurately as well, Sweden is characterized as a individualistic society, and that and a non-religious one at that. So that the focus in many of the studies in aging, but in other areas as well, is on the internal resources we bring to the situation, which can be developed over time. Where I think in the U.S. we would maybe have a broader sense of resources, which maybe have to do with religious orientations and other kind of small group
faith-based issues.
Faith-based issues and so on. So I guess you could call this a secular version of religious life in some sense.
So what did you find?
Well, what we found confirming our major hypothesis, there was a what we call an exponential or very rapid decline in sense of coherence as people moved from their 60s to 70s, 80s, and 90s. So it was a very sharp drop-off, especially between the 80s and into the 90s in age.
And in what way did that show itself? In other words, what types of questions were asked? How did that become evident?
Well, we created what we call an index or a scale, which combined those three elements I talked about. This comes from Antonovsky. It's an adaptation of his scale that's been used all over the world in many health settings. So we combined these questions, the responses to these questions, into an index where a higher value meant a stronger sense of coherence. And we were able to then track these people over time and look at the change in their stated sense of coherence as it evolved. Over those decades.
So a statement might be that they felt less purpose, they had a less sense of meaning in their life?
Yeah, the questions, examples would be, I find meaning in my life, I find I can understand things that happen to me in my life, I feel that I have control over the things that occur to me in life. So it's very closely related to the labels that we give these concepts within the sense of coherence.
But what's interesting, and I've read ahead, so I kind of have the answer here, is that you found something that was also very contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
So that, tell us about that, that by removing certain factors, you found almost the opposite effect. So help us understand that.
Yeah, this is, it could be considered arcane as a statistical point, but I think it's very important substantively as well. What we found, and we didn't really hypothesize, but having found it, it's understandable, that once we controlled or removed the effects of declining health, of shrinking social networks, of widowhood, the usual deficits that occur in late life, we were able to find that sense of coherence actually increased, and not only increased, but increased quite rapidly through those 80s and 90s, where previously we found a decline. So the conclusion from that would be that if we were able to, let's say, maintain people's health, now this is, we know, not really possible, maintain their health so it doesn't decline, we can minimize decline, which would be helpful. But if we were in this kind of study, the conclusion we would draw is that if we can maintain people's health, stop them from being widowed, and so on, we would actually find that sense of coherence goes up.
Well, obviously, many of those things are not within our control, but I think that it leads us to... It's pause for thought in terms of what aspects of those things could make a difference. So in other words, what conclusions might you draw in terms of how we would, what can we take away from this data in terms of how we age in this country, for example?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, some things can't be controlled, others can. But what we can control is access to social involvement and social integration of older people, so that if they experience a loss, they can maintain or create new relationships. We can maintain health to a greater degree by intervening earlier in the life course. to have people live healthier lives, engage in healthier behaviors, so that the decline in their health is minimized as they reach these older ages.
Yes, so the things like continuing to remain in social groups or be active in some meaningful way mm-hmm. could in some way mitigate against that sense of loss of coherence.
Right, and this is all considered part of the successful aging formula. That we engage in social relationships, avoid disease, and maintain physical function. Those three things are kind of key in terms of our ability to maintain a successful late old age.
Very helpful and interesting information. Thank you so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Merrill Silverstein, Professor of Sociology and Social Work and the Marjorie Cantor Professor of Aging Studies at Syracuse University. Once again, thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Bruce Bennett is professor emeritus at Wells College. He is a poet with over a dozen books to his credit and the master of many poetic forms. But his concise lines are a delight in this very short poem called Loony. The loon has no idea that he's a loon. He's just another bird who has a tune that others think is loony, cracked, bizarre. The names we're called are rarely what we are.
Thank you for joining us for HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we explore the newest options for dealing with cancer pain. Plus, the new AMA president addresses issues facing medicine. And will we be ready for the demands facing all the health professions today and in the future? HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.